Keith Recker has been called the poet laureate of color. His new book is Deep Color, The Shades That Shape Our Souls, where he discusses the power of color as a force in our lives, a major influence in visual and verbal communication, and on the decisions that we make daily. Keith Recker's work with Pantone opened our eyes to the incredible conversation surrounding color and even the role of technology in its evolution. From the DNA of color to the sustainability and origins, Keith has a way of opening up our worldview. Again, the name of the book is Deep Color, The Shades That Shape Our Souls, and we welcome Keith Recker to the roundtable this morning. Keith, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you back on the program. Give us a sense of what brought you to this particular subject.
Well, as a person who's been active in the color world for about 20 years, I was invited just before the pandemic to talk to groups of high school students about the role color plays in communication on a daily basis. What messages were coming to them through marketing, through photographs, through branding, on the grocery store shelves, through clothing. And as these really perceptive high school students asked questions, they drove me deeper and deeper and deeper into the history of color, how it acts upon us, what it makes us think, how quickly it makes us think those things. And the next thing I knew, through all the research I was doing to answer their questions, this book was born.
What does it make, or how long, I guess, does it gestate to make us feel a certain way through a color, of that making us feel a certain way?
It happens instantaneously. And because it happens so quickly, we don't really think much about it. At the Pantone Color Institute, we have a couple of statistics that I find really compelling. One is that 95% of a decision to purchase is driven by visual information. And of that, over 80% is color alone. That immediate experience of seeing is very commanding in our experience. It tells us what to do practically, very driving.
You have so many interesting things in here, but basically it gets to what we think and what we expect. And I guess I'm interested of how much is internal and how much is trained. So, for example, if we see packaging and it has green lettering, it could either mean fat free or that it's a product good for the environment. We're sort of trained on those things. How does that training become? And then it slips in so that we keep it with us for a really long time.
Yeah, it's true. I think the nature-nurture question is timeless, right? We may never actually answer.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of color, you bring up green. It's a very good example. Of course, it's deep-seated to appreciate green as the color of nature because, of course, when we open our eyes, even in the most arid environment, we're looking for green as a sign of life, as a sign of water, as a sign of, nourishment and possibility. That's super ancient, Garden of Eden sort of stuff. Amazing. We also start to see green being used in the context of a color of revolution and rebellion because we're so worried about the health of the environment, right? So Greenpeace, for example, harnesses their green T-shirts and their green banners and all that sort of thing, and it starts to become a bit of a battle cry. And recently, we see in France the Gilets Jaunes protests, where these safety vests of a neon yellow green have come to symbolize a proletarian call to arms. It's like, we are not healthy. We are not doing well. You must help us. So, yeah, green has been moving along to become a real activist color as opposed to merely a peaceful and nourishing color.
You talk about white, of course, the absence of color, and what that can say about a person, that purity of white.
It's true. That, too, is pretty deep-seated. The shining raiment that the righteous wear in certain passages in the Bible, for example, that comes from a certain link between light and white, right? So the shining garments get interpreted quite often as white garments, but it's really more about the shine of it. And that does lead us to some metaphors about purity and purity of purpose. We see people in the 20th century like Gandhi in India, We see the suffragettes donning white as a symbol of principle and purpose and even leadership. I think we have to be a little careful not to only take that at face value. Some people, of course, don white, and it's hypocritical. The white robes, for example, of the KKK have nothing to do with virtue. It's a self-proclaimed and untrue declaration of principle, right? So that was part of the reason that I really wanted to turn this into a book, turn the series of talks into a book, because I think we deserve to back up a little bit and be conscious about what people are promising, what people, brands, activities, images are promising with their use of color, and really give us a chance to look at whether they're delivering on that promise.
When you think of color, and especially, I know you talk in the book about things like color and class. So give us a history of that, of when that starts and how then it starts to permeate.
Yeah, I'm going to go way back. There is evidence found by archaeologists examining pollen samples in the various strata of soil in a cave in the Republic of Georgia. They found evidence of twisted flax fibers that were dyed in yellow, green, pink, blue, gray. We don't know what those twisted flax fibers were used for, but it starts to me wonder whether we've been using color as a differentiator from thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago, whether it was to differentiate things in different sacks, whether it was to differentiate people or special occasions or seasonality, we don't know. But to develop a variety of color options that far back, it was about something. So the differentiation aspect is super ancient, I think. In terms of color being a class signifier, we humans have found ways to signify class in any number of media. Of course, color is certainly part of it. I think you can look at the sumptuary laws of Europe as an example, you know, where in certain societies like Venice, certain colors were off limits to the working class, like red. In certain societies like Japan at a certain period of time, merchants and working people were told they could only wear shades of blue, gray, brown, because other colors were designated to other people. Incidentally, that restriction on blue being the color of merchants and working people made Japan into the indigo master it continues to be, because as merchants became a little richer through commerce and through the opening up of Japan to global commerce, indigo was pushed into some really innovative spaces. So you've got resist dyeing, you've got tie dyeing, you've got weaving, you've got stenciling, you've got batik. Phenomenal range indigo was pushed into, even though it was at first a restriction.
When you look at the colors that speak to us, where does that come from? How innate is that?
Yeah, color as a motivator, color as a mechanism, seems pretty deep within us. There's a study that I mentioned in the book, in the chapter on red, where scientists looked at the behavior of rhesus macaque monkeys at feeding time. They asked the feeders to wear either an outfit of all red or all blue or all green. And the handlers wearing all red were over 30% less likely to have food stolen from them when they went out to do the feeding than the people wearing blue and green. And the hypothesis there, you know, was about, well, could we possibly be evolutionarily cued in to have red be a symbol of dominance? So we may just have some color signals built deeply into us.
Right.
But then we have the cultural level and we have the personal level. I opened the chapter on purple, talking about my own special relationship with purple based on how much my beloved grandmother used to love purple. And it has kind of a unique and very reverential place in my heart. We can have any range of reactions, right? From embedded evolutionarily to socially long held to personally formed.
Ultimately, what do you hope people take from the book?
I start the book with a quote from Claude Lévi-Strauss saying that myths operate in men's minds without their knowing it. And I think that's kind of how color is with us. It reaches in and it makes us feel things, and we really haven't examined that mechanism. We don't really know what's at work. And I think in this image-driven world, we need a way to step back and say, oh, wait a minute, you know, just because there's some green on that packaging, as you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, doesn't make it environmental. It wants you to think that it's environmental or healthy or natural. But is it? And we deserve the chance to just create a little space between all the persuasion that's coming at us through images and our own actions and judgments.
The new book is Deep Color, The Shades That Shape Our Souls. Keith Recker, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Deep Color, The Shades That Shape Our Souls by Keith Recker. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.